Yeah, this is very good. Okay, so like everybody else, I want to start by thanking the organizers for inviting me to come here and give a talk. It's really terrific. And also, this is my first time in Toronto. It's partially one of the reasons why I accepted, but I can't say no to you guys. It's really, really good to be here. And the talks have been really very good, and I've enjoyed them, and you could probably tell that I have enjoyed them. This talk was longer, okay, and I kept paring it down because, you know, every talk that went by the past couple of days kind of involved some of the things that I wanted to tell you, okay? So Ellen took about 5 slides, and Tom took another few slides, and you know, Rich took a few more. So I have 5 slides, and I'm going to try to stretch them out somehow. It's going to be quite hard. But in, you know, semi-seriously, I'm going to talk about lenses, and these lenses are going to be laden with surfactants, okay? And they're going to be finish, so that I can use lubrication theory, and then let's see how we go. Right, let's see if this thing works. Here we go. So I guess I don't need to tell this audience why I want to study lenses. I asked Ewan yesterday why he wants to know whether the lipid layer buckles or doesn't buckle, and he said, oh, because I have a romantic interest in understanding the deep underlying physics, or something to that effect, okay. So I guess we all share that kind of passion for understanding what happens, but partially the motivation for what I want to do is to generate a model that can produce 2 or 3 generic effects, okay. One of these generic effects has to do with the spreading of the lens if it has the fact. That's kind of the trivial thing. Of course it has to spread, okay. But can it do something a bit funkier? Can it spread and then retract and come to a halt? Can it spread, come back, go back, come back, you know, executing sustained oscillations? Can it do all these things? So part of the motivation goes back to the work that was done by Ernst van Nierop. He was one of Howard Stone's, I think, postdocs. In fact, those of you who remember the IPAM meeting back in 2006, I think you might remember that Ernst had a poster there where he had this on in the poster. And so this is a lens, okay, you can see an equilibrium configuration there of a lens of a certain fluid sitting on another underlying fluid, which starts to spread under the action of Marangoni. So there's a situation where the spreading coefficient becomes positive and it starts to spread out this way. And then there's a chemical reaction at the liquid-liquid interface. And we're looking at this from the top, so you can't tell that there's anything going on because it's happening beneath the lens. That chemical reaction brings the spreading coefficient back down to negativity, allowing the lens to retract, and then it goes back to an equilibrium position, and it stays there. So one of the things that the model ought to be able to do is capture this somehow. Okay. So this one is nice. But it's not as nice, okay, as this sort of behavior. What you're looking at here is the radius of a lens, which is doing this. So it's pulsating. And okay, so maybe don't read too much into the signal. You know, is it chaotic? Is it quasi-periodic? Forget about that. The generic thing here is that it's oscillating, and these oscillations are sustained in a way. Even though it looks as though the amplitude might be decaying slightly, but nonetheless. So this is the work of John Bush. Okay? John has an eye for cute things like that, you know. And this is one of those cute things, and this is Stocker. This is the Stocker that used to work with Pecco. I don't know where he is now, but anyway, it's not important. So this lens here, you're going to see later on that I'm going to talk about the effect of evaporation as well, but it's going to be the evaporation of the surfactant. So the surfactant that's used here is a volatile surfactant and can undergo evaporation, and I'm going to use that in my model, but I'm going to do it in a very kind of in a non-fundamental way. So you'll have a look at that. But I claim that we're able to reproduce a behavior like this and a behavior like this. This one here is the spreading of a surfactant solution droplet on the surface of a gel layer, and this is the work of Karen Daniels. And the first time I saw this, I think I remember it was the November 2005 APS, DFD meeting, And this was before I, Pam, and Karen was working on this problem, I think, at the time. And there, so what you see there is, you know, this is the droplet that was deposited here, okay, and the Marangoni gradients which spread the droplet out, and when the droplet spreads out, it fractures the underlying gel. And when it does that, it produces these really attractive looking fingers, which she calls starbursts, okay, lovely looking things. And since then, we've started to work on this problem, and we've reproduced her results, but this experiment, so I'm doing experiments, of course I'm not doing them myself, I do them by proxy, somebody who knows how to do experiments. But these starbursts here, you can see that the shapes of these fingers and the wavelength here, that obviously depends on the strength of the surfactant solution and also the strength of the underlying gel layer. So the part of the motivation for the work here is I want to generate a model that can capture this behavior, but that I want to graduate up to a situation where my underlying layer is not Newtonian, it's some kind of Neo-Hookean solid or something of that type. But the important thing is I want to be able to capture what happens at the tips of these fingers where there's cracking likely to happen. So this is an important generic thing that we need to graduate into as the field grows. We need to do this sort of thing. It's important. Okay? So we've done this for agar, we've done this also for gelatin, where for gelatin the fractures heal themselves. And I have pictures, but my pictures are not as nice as Karen's. Okay, so I'm just showing you Karen's pictures here. They look really still very attractive. So okay, what about the formulation of the problem? So we have a schematic, like everybody else, looks like this. What else, right? It's a lens. Okay, it's there, and then it's sitting on top of another fluid, and these two fluids are immiscible, so there is an interface separating the two fluids there. And whereas Ellen was very sensible and called her interfaces ABC, whatever it is, look at the cumbersome notation we've used. So H12, H13, H23, yeah, ridiculous, obviously. And then wait till I show you the fluxes as well, then I have the four numbers in the fluxes. Just insane. But there's a method to the madness, right? This is fluid 1, fluid 2, fluid 3. The border between 1 and 2 is 1, 2. Okay. The border between 2 and 3 is 2, 3. Border between 1 and 3 is 1, 3. So there is some structure there. And importantly, there is surfactant that sits inside this lens. And the surfactant can behave as a monomer. So these little guys which are swimming around in there, not exactly swimming, but you know, they're there, okay? They could attach themselves onto this interface or this interface. They could diffuse ahead of the contact line, so they could live here. And that's going to be one of the things that I'm going to need to allow in my model, okay, in order for me to try to explain the sustained oscillation. So make it a placeholder in your mind for later on. I'm going to allow this to happen ahead of the contact line, and then I'm going to allow that surfactant here to come off this interface in some form of evaporation. But the way I'm going to model it will simply be like a sink term. So very simple. And these surfactants, crucially, can also exist above what we call the critical micelle concentration, and they can form these clumps of what Shilpa called conglomerates. Aggregates, not conglomerates. Okay, so they're aggregates. These are micellar objects that look like this, and I'm assuming that they look spherical. They could, depending upon the type of surfactant, undergo different transitions to different shapes and so on. Okay, these micelles cannot, in my model, attach themselves directly to any of these interfaces. So they have to undergo breakup into the monomers. And then the monomers attach themselves. So I'm not actually allowing these micelles to attach themselves directly, but there's work out there that says that is in fact a possibility. So these micelles can go up to the interface and unzip themselves, and then suddenly, you know, you have a large flux of monomers to the interface, giving rise to a substantial Marangoni kick there. So. And I'm going to cut out quite a lot of the derivations because people have been through this, so I don't want to bore people. But One of the important things that I want you to remember is that, you know, I'm going to be careful in how I treat that contact point, because I have a an honest contact line. I have a, you know, a contact point there, so I don't have a precursor. And I have used precursors in the past, okay, to look at a variety of things, one of which was a lens problem. So there's a paper, Richard Krasner and I wrote an article in JCI, Journal of Colour Interface Science 2006, where we have lenses with, I think, no surfactants, but with a precursor. And that paper was okay, except, can you see how I've drawn this schematic here? This schematic basically shows you a crucial feature, in the sense that ultimately, if you have an equilibrium configuration for this lens, this will exist with a finite bend. And I think you saw this in some of your equilibrium configurations, Ellen. You have this finite bend. Turns out that when you use the precursor, at least the way we did it, we were unable to capture this crucial feature. So, you know, no matter how thin we made the precursor, and that had to do with some technical issue that I'm going to discuss here, but sometimes I guess the message is that it's important to include a contact line, right? So one of the things I'm going to do is to look at transfer of surfactant right at the contact point. Okay, so that's coming up. So I basically told you that these monomers can attach and detach, and the way that, you know, the underlying chemistry, if you like, is mass action kinetics. So imagine, right, that you have a monomer that lives up here. Okay, so he is occupying some space. So what he wants to do is potentially he could come off the space, okay, swim through here, and then come here, and then find a space on this interface, and then collide with it, annihilating it, thereby sitting on the interface. And that's captured by, as it happens, this process is captured by this equilibrium process here. So, and if you generalize that to many, many monomers, then you end up talking about concentrations of these, species. So basically, there's an equilibrium process here between the concentration of the monomer that lives, say, at this interface, with the space at this interface here, so that, you know, they get together and this one is allowed to sit there, and then the other side of this is if one of these guys over here comes off this interface and then wants to go there, then he needs to collide with a space there, and that space is S23. So S is, if you like, the area available for, or empty space available for these monomers to attach themselves. And this is these are the underlying kinetics that give you the sorption kinetics formulae that we end up using in our equations. Yeah, so it depends on what's on the other side, okay? Because of these monomers have a hydrophobic tail and hydrophilic head, and so it depends on the affinity that these moieties would have to what's on either side of the interface. So they may like to live on one interface in preference to another because of these energetic considerations. So all of these 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 have to do with events such as the ones I've just finished describing. So attachment, detachment, absorption, desorption. This here has to do with the breakup and the formation of micelles. So if essentially you have N monomers getting together to form a micelle. If you generalize that to many, many of those, you end up talking about concentrations of the monomers inside the bulk, C2. Yeah, times a number of these monomers, they end up giving you micelles, and then the reverse process breaks up the micelle to give you back the monomers. And N here depends on many things, the nature of the surfactant, the surrounding medium, and it could be 80, 100, etc. Except I think in our simulation it's like 10, or something like this. I mean, I think we probably could have pushed on the number, but we kept it, you know, at a number reasonably larger than 1. I don't think it affects the dynamics that much. I think it just affects things in a minor quantitative way. The other thing that we're going to say is that we have lubrication theory. So these lenses are slender, and that's, I guess, a reasonable approximation to make. So any vertical scales here end up being much smaller than scales in this direction. I'm working in two-dimensional geometry, so this isn't axisymmetric, okay, this is 2D. And so there, the criterion for smallness, if you like, the thin film or the aspect ratio, a small parameter there, ends up being something like the volume of the lens per unit length, so it's like an area, divided by some characteristic length here squared. Okay, so there's that. So we're going to use lubrication theory, and everybody here, I assume, is familiar with lubrication theory. You take your mass momentum conservation equations, and then you expand using this lubrication parameter, leading all the terms, and then you can resolve the velocity very easily. Trivial calculation. Yeah. So basically, it comes through our scalings, and we rigged it in such a way so that the total mass deposited is scaled on the CMC, so that if we're above one, it's essentially the same as being above the CMC. Correct, correct. It could. So I'm just saying that if this were to happen, if these events were to happen, then they could be governed by these types of kinetics. But as you'll see in a minute, I could have attachment detachment, and then the monomer could live in there, and it could be swept along by Marangoni, and then at some point it could or could not detach. But if it were to, it would have to obey these mass action kinetics. The other important thing that we do, and I think that's somewhat related to a question that Michael asked to Jim. Is Jim here in the audience? Jim's sleeping, he's not here. You asked him a question about doing some cross-sectional averaging. I think with the context of, if you have a fluid which is, undergoing a bifurcation, and then you track then the volume fraction of the one of the fluids inside the pipe. In this case, what we do is we perform a cross-sectional averaging of slightly another type here. So we are assuming that this vertical scale is very small, so that the concentration variations in this direction are smeared out very, very quickly by diffusion. Okay, so they disappear very rapidly. So we're in the rapid vertical diffusion limit. And the way that we exploit this is by expanding all of our concentrations in powers of this parameter squared times the Peclet numbers. Okay, so we're saying that that parameter is very small, and we're saying that any Z variations come at that order, and if they do, I can cross-sectionally average them out. There's a nice paper by Jensen and Grotberg in 93 that in Physics of Fluids which does this, and I've used that quite extensively past God knows how many years now. Okay, so it's a nice paper. Jensen and Grotberg, Oliver Jensen and Jim Grotberg, 93, Physics of Fluids. So we do this here. And again, I'm sparing you a lot of the details. They are trivial, anyone can do them. Okay, so if you do all this, and then you resolve your velocity field, and you make use of, so you have continuity of velocity here, a kinematic boundary condition here, you have a kinematic boundary condition over here, you have a tangential stress balance that gives you the Marangoni stress in here, ditto over here, you have continuity of the tangential stress, you have a jump in the normal stress balanced by the curvature here and here. So you have to take all of these things into account, as I'm sure everybody here knows, and when you do this, you generate evolution equations, okay? And these evolution equations, they look like this, for example. I have three of them, one for this interface, one for this, and then one for this interface. And I should say that I'm working in, I'm assuming that I have four aft symmetry here after x is, at x is zero, so I'm only solving the half problem. I'm not obviously solving the full problem. And I have no reason to solve the full problem. I'm not expecting any symmetry breaking here, so it's, I think, okay. Safe to do this. So then I have these evolution equations, and they look like that. I have these fluxes here, And these fluxes have been written in shorthand form, so when they generically depend on the locations of the interfaces, the position of the interfaces, and then the sigma here, that I have, of course, more than one sigma, three of them, for each interface has a sigma. That sigma will depend on the interfacial concentration, and that's what's going to end up coupling all these equations together. And the dependence, the functional form of the sigma on the interfacial concentration is coming up in a couple of slides. I need something called an equation state, and people asked questions about equations of state yesterday. Don't think that they're in the audience today. Someone from, I think, local person. So I have these three equations here. Then there is an equation here for the concentration of the monomers inside the lens. And this came from the cross-sectional averaging procedure. So I've got an unsteady term. This is, if you like, part of the advective term. This comes from the diffusive term. And then we have the fluxes. So this is the kind of cumbersome notation that we use here. Look at this. JC2C12, okay? We couldn't call it, you know, JA or JB. No, that would be, you know. So, but what's the method behind this? Okay, so JC2C12, all it's saying is that there's an attachment from the monomers, they have a concentration C2, onto this interface, but that's interface 1-2, so you have this guy here. And the analogous one for upstairs is this one. Okay, so it's very easy if you look at it. And these are coefficients which essentially are related to the solubility, okay, of the surfactants. And I should have probably shown you the scaling so you could see where these come from, but these, you could think of them as solubilities. Okay, so these two, and then you have J2. So there's a contrast in the complexity of the notation. But this J2 is related to the breakup, okay, and formation of my cells. So you could see here that I could have a contribution here, like a sink, which takes away monomers in order to create my cells, and that sink becomes a source into my cell concentration equation. So there is some underlying structure here. So this is my micelle concentration equation, M being the concentration of micelles, M for micelles. Okay. Yeah, so the reason is that these interfaces, because I was telling Linda earlier, if you look at these monomers, imagine that this is, if you like, I don't know, in this present case it's like an oil sitting on top of water. The tail is organic, so it wants to be here, but the head doesn't, and so they migrate up here. But then they do enough of that to the point where the interface is saturated, they've got no other place to go, and so energetically it's much better for them to get back into here, but the heads don't like it, and so they clump together in such a way, you probably can't see this, but the heads are inside, protected by the tails.
So if that all happens,
yeah.
So
then. Yeah. So. Right. So the issue here is that this is a fairly simplistic picture. There's a dynamic equilibrium here, where these monomers come off and on, they form micelles and they break them up. It's happening in dynamic equilibrium. So,
So
I guess there are fluctuations here at the interface where, you know, it could be that these fluctuations might kick one of these monomers out here, and there could be a monomer waiting in the wings in the subphase that would take its position, and then that monomer that came out has then a choice of waiting for space to become available at the top to go back, or it has a choice to see whether a monomer has broken up so it can join it. So there's a process of dynamic equilibrium. That's my understanding. You mean don't have a monomer, but just have the interfaces covered with... Sorry, don't have a micelle, but just have monomers. Yeah. So we have two parameters that allow us to do exactly what you said. So there is a parameter which defines the affinity. Plan B. There is a. Here it is. So can you see this? So there's a parameter that defines the affinity for the surfactant to want to be in the micellar form or wanting to be in a monomer form. So we have that. And then we have another parameter which describes how easy it is to hop onto either this interface or this interface. And we could change those. We could tweak. In fact, this problem is a really dirty problem in the sense that we have about 20 parameters to play with. So we could do these things. It's possible for us. I noticed, I think there was one of...
You have lots of division by zero at triple junction. So does it give you kind of boundary conditions for...
We don't have... Yeah, so I can see what you mean. So you're looking at this, and you're thinking, at the triple junction, I'm going to have an issue here.
You're going to need to have a implicit boundary condition for concentration gradient.
Well, so the way we solve this is through the method of finite elements. And the point at the boundary ends up becoming a contribution to the by parts part of the finite element, so it ends up not being an issue there at all, okay? And the way we kill that also is by imposing right at the contact line the continuity of the heights. So there's in fact, one of the reasons why we use the finite element approach was so that we could make sure that we wire this information into the code that would solve these equations by hand. See what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because otherwise, you're right, you'd end up with some issues there. Yeah. Yeah, that might be... Let me think about this. Yeah, I'm with you. No, I think I can account for that issue. So the origin is from here. Okay. So, and when I do my cross-sectional averaging, I do this, and then I say C, which can depend on X, Z, and T, is C naught X T plus epsilon squared, whatever the relevant Peclet number is for that interface or that medium there, C1 X Z T. If I put this information in here, I will retain only this guy, and then when Yes, exactly. So yes, it's basically UC this plus WC this, etc. But then UX plus WZ is zero. So it's not beyond me to have a typo in these equations. Okay. Right. So now we finish with these equations here, but don't forget that we have interfacial species that we need to think about as well. And so the C12, C13, C23, these are the interfacial concentrations for the species that live on cursor. Thank you. Okay, at this interface, and this interface, and so I have these three equations here. And you can see that, for example, this equation for the concentration of the monomers at this interface has a contribution from the sorptive flux acting as a source. Okay, so you have attachment from the bulk onto that interface. Now, if you think about the other ones, so have a look at this one here. That's an equation for the interfacial species at this interface, and the surfactants got there by diffusing through the contact line and being ahead. Now remember what I said to you before, I'm trying to capture situations where I have this pulsating lens, and so Stocker and Bush could only capture that by allowing some of that surfactant to evaporate. They used a volatile surfactant, and then when they allow evaporation by taking the lid off their apparatus, they could see the pulsation. So I'm effectively trying to plan ahead for that. So I'm going to allow this JEV13 here to be non-zero to hopefully see whether that has any bearing on the oscillations or not. Okay. And then the final equation over here could allow for evaporation, so the surfactants being volatile coming off the top of the lens, although we end up not really using that very much. And they also allow for direct attachment and detachment from the bulk of the lens. Okay, so I have these three equations. And they have the convective term on the left-hand side, which has to do with Marangoni. So the Marangoni is buried inside these interfacial velocities there. Okay, and then of course they have the diffusive terms, which are the ones which are proportional to the inverse Peclé numbers, like that. The way that all these equations are coupled together is related, of course, to this sigma here, and that sigma is dependent on the interfacial concentrations through this equation of state. Now, I don't actually think that it's an arbitrary choice, you know, to make this equation state, although I end up always doing exactly that, because with the exception of one problem that I looked at, I think that these equations of states end up giving you quantitative differences rather than qualitative differences. I think one problem only, when we looked at the breakup of a jet with surfactant at very high concentrations, that equation of state made a difference. These problems, not so much. So we end up using what people in the literature refer to as the Chaloupko equation. Jim used this way back when, back in 1990, or I think there's a paper, 92 JFM experiments, where they measured the surface tension and its dependence on the interfacial concentration and fitted it to the Chaloupko equation. And it kind of looks like this. And so we need to have one of these for each one of the interfaces, because the surfactants can, you know, attach themselves to any one of those. We end up with parameters that look a little bit like this. So we're scaling our surface tensions on surface tension differences. We end up with these big sigmas, etc. And as I mentioned to you, it's a disaster of a problem. It's not clean by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, you know, and I don't have the patience to change every parameter. By the way, I should have really acknowledged the huge contribution of George Karapetsis, who's the postdoc who did all this work. I mean, one of those guys where you kind of try to stay out of his way. If you interfere, he might slow things down. So he's good. He's back in Greece now, so I have a feeling I'll be seeing him very, very shortly, because that country's going to undergo finite time blow up very, very rapidly. Okay, so these are the equations. And then I better talk about the boundary conditions. I already alluded to the kinematic boundary condition and the stress conditions, etc. We have the trivial issue of the no slip boundary condition at the bottom wall here. And Jim was going to make a joke about, I'm not going to plot any velocity fields or any streamlines, or I don't care about the stress field, you know. And I have a solid wall here, I don't have a cornea or whatever. But he's not here, so it's a shame. Maybe you could tell him I said all these things. So. Okay. So then the issue of the contact lines is quite an important one. And again, I think Ellen did a terrific job of explaining the step-by-step of what you do there. So I'm going to try and I'm not going to try and match that, of course. I'm just going to repeat mostly what you said. And so we have to have the continuity of the heights at the three-point line there. There exist force balances that need to be imposed. At every instant of the spreading, those force balances must happen on a really rapid time scale. Well, that's the thinking behind this. And these force balances must be resolved in the horizontal direction, as well as the vertical direction. And they involve these angles that you see there in the top right-hand corner. those angles are related directly to, so they're expanded out using lubrication theory, and they end up depending on quantities such as the gradients that you could see here. Okay, so over and above the situation that you might have if you had an uncontaminated lens, you would have a situation where you'd have these reasonably complicated functions of sigma, which sigma then depends on the local concentration of surfactant. So that dynamically you're altering these balances as you go along, as the surfactant adsorbs and dissolves locally and also directly at the contact line. Okay, so we have that. And we have a continuity of the pressure, or really a continuity of the stress there, and I've written it in shorthand form here. I should have mentioned actually that this paper has appeared. Okay, I'm really bad at doing things of this type. But so this paper here, the work here has appeared in Physics of Fluids I think it's either the December edition or the January edition. If you want the details, they will be there. If you want me to send you the paper, I can do that. It's very easy. Or you can download it these days, of course. By the way, I still get emails from, or not emails, I get postcards from people in certain countries that want hard copies of papers. I think that's really cute. So I end up responding. So then the other issue is, whereas in a situation where you have a liquid spreading on a substrate, and then the contact line velocity there has to be somehow prescribed by some kind of a semi-empirical formula because of the famous no slip, because of the contact line singularity that exists there, it's possible for us to circumvent that problem in liquid-on-liquid spreading by using mass conservation. So you could probably just about see in these integrals here, the upper limit is the contact line position as a function of time. And so we ask the question, what should the contact line position be at every instance in time such that I can recover a fraction of the total mass of both fluids, which is arbitrarily close to one, okay? And so then I use these conditions to advance the contact line. I think Ellen uses something similar to this, probably identical to this, I would imagine. We played around with other things. So we played around with prescribing the velocity, we did other things. This is completely kosher. I'm really happy with this condition here. But it turns out we had numerical problems where we deviated away from imposing a condition like that. The other comment I wanted to make here was, could we basically address the issue of liquid on solid spreading by approaching that problem through this problem? So you can imagine, you have a condition here which is lovely, right? Well, who could argue with mass conservation? It's there. Okay, a mass conservation. But what if I made the viscosity of the bottom fluid much higher than the top fluid? Can I recover liquid on solid spreading? Is it possible for me in some limit? And I think the answer is no, but I don't remember the real technical reason for this. There is something singular that happens. I remember telling George about that, and he went away for a few days and came back, said it couldn't be done. I believed him, and I parked it in my mind that, yeah, it couldn't be done. We dealt with it. I don't remember why. But anyway, so we're not talking about that. We're talking about this now. So that's what we've used there. Okay. And then before I start to get into the results and et cetera, I just need to tell you one other thing about the contact point. So in this and in a related problem that we had, which had to do with superspreading, how many people have heard of superspreading here? 4, 3, 5 people? No. Four out of whatever it is, 20 people. So in that problem, you have a situation where you could have a really non-wetting substrate, and you put a droplet on it, and then if you put some surfactant, which is a so-called a super spreader, has some super powers or something, well, we know what these powers are, it turns out, okay? It spreads this drop, which would have otherwise beaded up at an angle of even bigger than 90 degrees, it spreads it to complete wetting conditions really rapidly. Why does this happen? Okay, so it turns out that a credible mechanism for this is direct transfer onto the contact point. If you do this, then the spreading is really quick. And not only this, but you can also recover the weird shapes that the droplets produce. They produce these pancake-looking shapes really quickly. I mean, you're taking this drop, which is, you know, a drop, and then you're turning it into something that looks like a pizza. Imagine, right? You have a ridge of the pizza. It looks like that. And you get that by allowing there for there to be transfer of surfactants at the contact point. So we're doing this in this case as well. And we have three fluxes here that allow us to do precisely this. So potentially, so what we're saying here is, imagine that, you know, you wanted to have cursor. Okay. Suppose you wanted to, you know, look at this point here, and you wanted to allow for there to be a diffusive flux here, say, so that you can have a bit of diffusion from the contact line up this way, then this is the sort of condition you could write down where, you know, this is a diffusive flux and this is a sorptive flux. And if you stare at this very carefully, it says JC13C12, okay, which means that we're talking about, you know, transfer of surfactant not from the bulk to the contact point, but actually along the interfaces. So we have, you know, molecules of surfactant that were at interfaces adjacent to the contact line, and then they hop onto the contact line and they transfer surfactants directly that way. I can imagine that these are going to be hard to measure, and the kinetics associated with those types of processes are going to be hard to measure. But because of the success of the superspreading, because as far as I can tell, no other theory apart from some hocus pocus, okay, can explain that unless you allow for transfer at the interface. I think it would be important to try and make some progress in terms of measuring these parameters. So enough of this rambling. What about some results now? I have like, how many minutes do I have? About 10 minutes, 15 minutes?
Yeah,
10 minutes, okay. So the results, I could take out surfactants completely. I can end up with an uncontaminated lens, and I could get results which look like what you'd expect them. And I guess forget about everything else and just stare at maybe this here. So S is the dimensionless spreading coefficient. One thing I neglected to say, and if you were here for Ellen's talk yesterday, you might recall that there is a technical issue having to do with the restriction on the spreading coefficient. It has to scale like epsilon squared, I think, in order for the balances to work out at the contact line. We have that too, okay? And it would be weird if we didn't, right? Because the underlying physics of this have to have their anchors inside the uncontaminated model, so that's important. So S has to scale like that. And you may say, okay, well, if epsilon is small, how could you have S going up to 0.11? But let's just turn a blind eye to that. So if you have S being negative, then you could see, if you look at X sub C here, which is the position of the contact line, it starts off with something, and then it retracts, and then it maintains its position. So this means steady state. This means that the droplet has reached its equilibrium shape, and we have some equilibrium shapes in these two these two panels over here. When you do allow for spreading to happen, if the spreading coefficient is positive, the spreading takes place with a power law of 1/7. Okay, and so we capture this power law, and that's something that Jean-François Joni was able to demonstrate last century, you know, 1987, was a paper by him. So okay, so forget about all this. We're solving the dynamic problem. I always like to solve the dynamic problem because then you could see where you're going to get to and how you're going to get to it. And so now we have the surfactant-laden problem here, and so we start with a situation where if you didn't have any surfactant, then you would have an equilibrium configuration. You'd have a negative spreading coefficient if you didn't have the surfactant. So if you do have the surfactant, you get typically profiles that look like this. This is where a movie would have clearly been good, but don't have the movie. So the early times is t equals 0.1. You could see that there is a drop there, which is reasonably fat and, you know, kind of stout like this. And it starts to spread out, and you could see the formation of this. It's not a shock structure, but if you really tighten the parameters, if you made the Peclet numbers large, etc., Mangoni really strong, you can get what Jim was on about yesterday, which is the GBG, right? You say GBG shock. Okay, but then the lens you could see here is this thin layer which has been really deformed because of Mangoni, you know, pushing downstream. This is early-ish times. This is later times, so 10 to the 2 dimensionless seconds, you get a lens which looks like this, okay? And then if you really push on times to 10 to the 5, okay, then you end up with a lens that has this sort of shape. So it retracts a little bit, it goes up, and it assumes this sort of position. But en route to that, there's some very interesting dynamics there. What about the effect of M? So Michael was on about, you know, where are you in terms of the CMC, etc. So here's a partial response to this, right? So if M is zero, there's no surfactant at all. And if you start with a situation where the spreading coefficient is negative, you know, you have the contact line position, you know, you have retraction followed by steady state, nice lens. If you increase M with the rest of the parameters remaining fixed, then you could have a situation where, you know, you could have a bit of retraction, a bit of spreading, and then finally achieving an equilibrium configuration. And then if you progressively increase M some more, then there will be a considerable spreading period characterized by a parallel exponent, which is t to the 1/2 rather than t to the 1/7. And I think the origin of that is because you have a lot of surfactants inside your lens. It acts as a reservoir, so the minute you lose surfactant, you can always pump some surfactants to the front. You send out some soldiers to keep fighting, and the signature of this is t to the 1/2. It's no longer t to the 1/7. Okay. And these are some of the equilibrium shapes that you get at really long times. So by long times, I mean t equals 10 to the 5. And so the message there is, as you increase the amount of surfactant, this lens gets longer and longer and longer before it reaches equilibrium. What about other funky things that could happen? Well, what if I allow there to be an attachment directly at the contact point? If you do this, and the control parameter there is this rate constant, so this one here with the solid line, some attachment, this one here is quite a bit of attachment, and they all generically look the same, so you get this, if you like, inflationary period where the contact line just kind of shoots forward, and then it undergoes retraction. But this shooting forward there, and I didn't put a power law there, but you know, you could measure a power law. This is over 2 or 3 decades, so it's possible. It's higher than 1/2. In fact, in the experiments that people have done for the super spreading problem, the power law, would you believe, approaches unity. It's almost like you have a traveling front that moves outwards. I don't believe it. I don't believe it's unity, because the number of decades they use to get their exponent is not enough. Experimentally, it's not. But it's certainly not a seventh. It's not a tenth. It's not. It's really, really big. Something is happening there. Okay, so we get a similar sort of situation where we have this inflationary jump, and then we have retraction, and the dynamics are captured up there for K is 0.001, and then below here for this other situation here where the where K is a bit larger. And so you could see, you know, that there is quite a lot of very interesting and very intricate dynamics. But generically what happens is that this lens is deformed substantially because of the Marangoni flow. It used to be a big fat lens here. It gets deformed quite a lot. The fluid that's underneath it shoots away from it, okay, and then finally it retracts and forms a lens over here, and its final configuration really depends on the parameters that that, you know, we use in generating these results. And sometimes you get the entrapment of a bit of fluid over here towards the end. So, and we think that this jump followed by retraction explains partially some of the results from Van Nierop, because that's what they saw. What they did was they had a chemical reaction taking place at the liquid-liquid interface. We don't have a chemical reaction. We could have very easily had a chemical reaction at the liquid-liquid interface, giving rise to something like that. Although we haven't done it, my intuition tells me that we ought to be able to get something generically or qualitatively very similar to this. There are many ways of getting to this type of result. But the thing I want to tell you about in the final few minutes, if I can, is the sustained oscillations. So, good morning. How are you today? Wet, sir. Sorry to hear that. You missed all the rude things I said about you in your talk. Very good, Jimmy. Okay, so this is a Stocker and Bush result. And just to tell you a bit about what they think is going on. So imagine that you have a lens which has surfactant, and the surfactant can absorb at the bottom interface. When it does so you have to wait for it to happen because that's a diffusive process. Once it gets to the bottom interface, it alters the spreading coefficient. From negative, it becomes positive. It then starts to spread. Once it starts to spread, and I'm not showing this here, but the angle, this angle here, gets smaller. What they report in that paper is that when that happens, there is an azimuthal instability which shoots off streamlets of surfactants. Those surfactants then wind up over here ahead of the lens. When that happens, the spreading coefficient goes back to being negative. That then engenders the retraction. Okay, but then they allow for the surfactant that ended up being here to evaporate because it's a volatile surfactant. When that surfactant goes away, the spreading coefficient becomes positive again. Then the lens moves forward. This instability happens, the streamlets come out, they produce the surfactant which is ejected in this direction. That then gives you the retraction. There's evaporation of the surfactant, that then gives you the spreading. Do you see how it works? And it kind of happens like that. Evaporation is important because if they put a lid on the system, they don't see this. They see one event, but they don't see the sustained oscillations. How can I capture something like that? Even though I just finished telling you that there is a two-dimensional instability here and I have a 1D model. So there must be some funky business that I'm going to do here, okay? And so what I'm going to do is, I mean, of course, I could capture the oscillations. It wouldn't be fun if I had no story to tell you. But the way I do this is by allowing, A, for there to be evaporation, because remember what I told you at the beginning, one of those, in fact, the second equation for the concentration of the interfacial species at the liquid-air interface allowed for evaporation, so essentially the removal of surfactant from that interface. But also, what I do is when the lens spreads and the angle becomes sufficiently small, I allow there to be transfer of surfactant ahead of the contact line through diffusion, because I can. It's one of my boundary conditions at the interface. I can have diffusion ahead of the contact line. So I can activate that. The bit of business that I do is that when it starts to retract, you can imagine that as the lens retracts, the contact angle there becomes large. And when it becomes larger than a certain amount, I stop that diffusion process. So there's that bit of intervention, which I'm uncomfortable with, but in order to remove that, then I have to solve a 2D problem, which then should be able to capture naturally the emergence of this, of the streamlets that they have in the azimuthal direction. They have like little fingers that come out. So I think I can probably get those, but not obviously within a 1D model. And so I could get these sustained oscillations, and they depend on the rate of this removal of the surfactant by evaporation from the region ahead of the lens. So I could get generically, you know, this pulsating, beating heart type of lens. Okay, and then I'm just about to finish. I'm sorry for running over. But I also looked at the density ratio. I think Ellen looked at density ratios as well. This is with the fact that I think you did without the fact. Remember yesterday I was asking you what happens if you really push on the density ratio. When we push on the density ratio, you know, we end up getting things that look like this. So you know, this lens really starts to collapse because the density ratio is 10 to 1, okay? And so we start to get these funky looking shapes for the interface and the potential for entrapment of a bit of fluid here. And these regions over here don't rupture in finite time unless you break them through intermolecular forces. And you get local to this, the type of behavior that one might get in, people remember the Hammond problem. I don't know if you know this Hammond. So there they drain, the fluid drains, it takes an infinite time for the fluid to drain. So this would never ever break unless you put it into molecular forces. And of course you'd have to eventually, because they come into operation. But the point is that if you have these density ratios, it's possible to have entrapment beneath them of the bottom fluid. And some conclusions then. I acknowledge the contribution of my colleagues, George and Rich Craster, but mostly George, because he did most of this stuff. And it's 10 o'clock, so I better be quiet. Thank you very much. So, I don't. One thing I don't allow it to do. Where's the home key here? One thing I don't allow it to do is I don't allow the surfactant to dissolve and go down to the substrate layer. That's the only thing I don't allow it to do, although I could, but I don't. Otherwise, it's allowed to dissolve from the top interface, go into the bulk, directly adsorb onto the contact line or at the bottom interface. It's free to do whatever. I don't restrict it in any other way. Yeah, it could do that. It could do this. Yeah. I have three conditions that allow me to do precisely this. Yeah. Sorry? I heard angle, I heard did you check, but I didn't hear that. Neumann law?
Yeah.
So, okay. So that's essentially built into my model. Okay? So it's built into, if I show you the details of my equations, then you'll see that's done. Yeah, so there's a bend. Even that bend is retained even at equilibrium. And if you don't use an honest contact line where you have to impose those conditions there, if you use a precursor, you can't get them. I guess so. I think I want to say we've tried playing around with things like that. But when you do this, what do you mean? I mean, there's no gravity, there's no tipping here. This is the same. It needs to match the same two outfield conditions, right? Maybe I'm missing something. We'll talk later, perhaps. You had a question, I think. Yeah, sorry, Linda. Yeah, I was going to talk for 5 minutes, but yeah, sorry. Yeah, so I think that's a really terrific question. I bet you, if I had a 2D problem, 2D model here, and I initiated that instability through some random noise, okay, then, between every one of these beatings, right, then you would get an essentially random amount of surfactant sent out from the lens, and I think that would probably give you the quasi-periodicity. But since I don't have it. Michael. Well, it's 2D for me in the lubrication approximation, because I've resolved that. Yeah, but 2D for me, 2D, no, but 2D for me is an extra dimension. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right. You can ask me.